Now, this is stating the obvious, but starting a business is no easy task, and starting a business with little to no funding or experience can be downright daunting. Yet entrepreneurs like you are out there doing it every day, and most importantly, they are succeeding at it. So what do they do to make it all work? Well, that's the million-dollar question, right? Well, since you have your copy of success in hand, you don't have to pay $1 million to find out. Instead, we asked two people who've experienced the highs and the lows of bootstrapping a business to stop by and give you their best advice for free. So listen closely. Michael Houlihan and Bonnie Harvey co-founded Barefoot Wine in their laundry room in 1986 and took it from nothing to an industry-changing and extremely successful wine label. They also authored the book, The Barefoot Spirit, How Hardship, Hustle, and Heart Built America's Number One Wine Brand. Since selling the company in 2005, Michael and Bonnie have spent their time sharing their experience and lessons with entrepreneurs and Fortune 500 companies around the globe. Michael and Bonnie, it's such a pleasure to have you here with us at Success. Welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
So, Michael and Bonnie, I alluded to how the two of you started the Barefoot Wine label, but since I know it's a much more interesting story than the few facts that I shared, tell us the full story of how and why Barefoot Wine came into existence.
Well, it was an opportunity that was presented to us, actually. I had a client, and he was a grape grower. For the past 3 years, he had not been paid for his grapes, I found out very quickly. And I thought, well, this is not going to do. So I sent Michael off to see if he could collect the funds from the winery that owed him the most money. When Michael got to the winery, he found out that they'd already been in the process of going bankrupt. They'd already filed for bankruptcy. So it did not look very good for my client. What Michael was able to negotiate eventually was a trade for bottling services and bulk wine. So we didn't have any money, and we didn't have any knowledge of the industry, but we started with almost $500,000 worth of bulk wine and bottling services. So it was really something that we had to take advantage of.
So you mentioned that you didn't really know anything about the wine business, and you sort of fell into it by accident. I mean, obviously, there wasn't a lot of funding or capital. So explain, you know, why you went ahead with it all anyway. What was the driving force that kept you both moving forward despite the obstacles that were in front of you right out of the gate?
Well, we went out and we asked people what was needed in the wine space. And we asked people who'd never been asked before, and they told us, and we got an insight into a niche, if you will, that there was an opportunity for a wine brand. And so we were convinced that this was a great idea because we already had buyers, we thought.
So what was the great idea? What was the wine business is so competitive, and everybody who loves wine thinks that they one day want to own a winery and be in the wine business, and many have tried and lots have lost lots of money. So what was the big idea that made this one work?
It was an idea that Michael got from a major chain buyer who was the wine buyer for a major chain in California. And Michael went there looking for advice. So he asked him a question. He said, what do you want? Where do you have space on your shelves? What does your customer want? And he said, well, nobody's ever asked me what I wanted before. Everyone comes here and sells me what they've got. I thought, well, that's interesting. So he said, as long as you've asked, I'm going to tell you. He said, what we want is a product that is accessible. We want a product. What did he tell him, Michael?
He said, we want a product that addresses our major market. And our major market, 78% of our shoppers are moms. They're the ones that are pushing this cart around. And they're looking for a wine that has a consistent flavor. It doesn't change from vintage to vintage. They're looking for a name they can pronounce. They want it soft and palatable, and they want it to be about the same price point as other 1.5-liter bottles of wine on the shelf. So he was telling me he wanted it in a 1.5-liter bottle. That's also known as a Magnum. It's twice the size of a 750. So that was a major key. He was saying that the label wanted to be seen from 3 feet away. He said that he thought that the name should be the same as the logo. So in about 4 or 5 minutes, this guy gave me the equivalent of a master's degree in wine merchandising.
Well, you just gave all of us the a master's degree in business, and that is with this one suggestion: ask people what they want. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, we forget to do the obvious, right? I mean, the biggest mistakes we make in business is not doing the obvious, and the obvious is ask people what they want and what they want that they know that their customers want. So that's brilliant already. All right. So out of everything that you encountered while you were bootstrapping your business to success, tell us what in those first few months or years was the most challenging aspect. And then, you know, those things that kept you up at night, and then how did you work around it?
Well, you know, people get into business and they have an idea about what that business is. And they're pretty well convinced ahead of time that this is the work that I'll do in my business. Well, I think what kept us up at night was the realization that our business had nothing to do with wine. Here we were producing a wine product, but our real business had everything to do with distribution management. I mean, imagine, all of a sudden we realized that we had 7 sales to make. We thought we were B2B, but we weren't. We were B2C. We had to sell the consumer, even though the consumer was buying from somebody who was buying from somebody who was buying from somebody who was buying from us. And we had to handle all the nuances and all those sales all the way through that distribution chain. And if we didn't do it, then it wouldn't be on the shelf. And if it was on the shelf and it sold, it wouldn't get replaced.
We found out that we had to make 7 sales.
We had to sell our own people. Then we had to sell our distributors' ownership. And they bought for a different reason. They bought for strategic reasons. They wanted to buy it because nobody else had it, or they wanted to keep other people from having it. Then we had to sell their sales manager, and he bought for a different reason. He bought because he found out we were going to have a representative in the neighborhood that was going to help him make his numbers. And then we had to sell his salespeople, and each one of these guys had like 100 salespeople, so we had to sell all of them. And they bought it because there was a spiff in it for them, or because our guy was going to make presentations to their customers and sell it for them. Okay, then we had to sell it to the retailers, and the retailers bought it for a different reason. They bought it because we had point of sale material and marketing material and whatnot. And then we had to sell it to his clerk, who was the guy who was actually going to put it up on the shelf and keep it there and talk to the customer where the rubber meets the road. And then we had to sell the customer. And so many people get into business and they jump right to the customer. They think, I'm going to sell this product because I can see how Mary Sue and Jamie Smith, they're going to like this product.
That is, again, really great advice. And everybody faces that challenge. They think that they are just selling to the end user. They have a great product. The end user is going to love it. But they forget about all the people and their individual agendas and the way that they're perceiving the world and what's important to them and that their stage of the process. So that's brilliant to lay that all out for us. Now, Bonnie, you have a saying that you use to describe how it was starting barefoot with no money and no experience, and that is, the fastest way to learn to dance is to have someone shooting at your feet. So give us more details about your lessons in dancing. Share the few biggest bullets, if you will, that were shot at your feet but resulted in a big lesson learned.
Exactly. Well, things are coming at you so fast when you're a young entrepreneur that you really have to keep your feet moving all the time just to stay in balance, or you're just going to fall right over. So one of the real shockers for me was that we had a lot of problem keeping personnel. People, for instance, I had a bookkeeper. She came in and she saw the big debt that we had assumed that had belonged to the winery. And now we owed the grower this huge amount of money. And about noontime, she picked up her hat and coat. And I says, you're going to lunch? She goes, no, I'm quitting. And I said, why are you quitting? She says, well, you don't have enough money to pay me. I looked at your books and you can't afford me. So she was out the door. So learning how to hire and fire was really challenging. Another thing that was very shocking for us is we immediately, as soon as we'd bottled, we entered a local competition. It was called the Sonoma Harvest Fair. Our Sauvignon Blanc took a gold medal. We were so excited. So over the weekend, they asked us to pour. All the gold medal winners were asked to pour their wines for the public. So we were very proud to do that. And someone from the Alcoholic Beverage Control came up to our table and said, do you have a license to pour this? And I said, well, yes, we were told that we were to pour because we took a gold medal. Look at this. And he says, no, you don't have a license to pour for the public. Therefore, you're going to be fined $10,000. $1,000. Well, I don't think we had $1,000 in our bank account at the time. So, whoa, we learned all about what it takes to sell to the public and how many different kinds of licenses are required in our business. There's federal licenses, there's state licenses, and there's a variety of both on both sides. So those are a couple of the bullets that were shot at us very unexpectedly.
Mm, yeah, Uncle Sam is your partner, like it or not, right? Yeah, like it or not. And he doesn't even have to invest in your startup. So now I recall reading in your book that you made friends in low places, and that was one of the biggest things that made a difference in your initial success. So explain what you mean by making friends in low places and how maybe other new businesses with little means but a lot of gumption can do the same.
Well, you have to take a look at how your product or your service is going to be handled, and you have to realize that people that are handling it know more about the business than you do. So when we say low places, we don't mean that as a disparaging remark. For instance, we had a problem with our product being out of stock at this particular store in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So we couldn't figure out why it ran out of stock because we saw that the distributor was in stock, but somehow it didn't make it to the retailer. So we called the distributor, and the distributor said, "Oh, no, we got plenty of that. You know, what's the problem?" "Oh, no problem." And so then we called the store, and the store said, "Oh, well, they delivered the wrong thing." We said, "Oh, really?" So then we were in Michigan, and we were doing some sales calls there. We decided that we would go and talk to the people at the distributorship and say, "How did this problem occur?" And they said, "Well, it's not our problem. You know, you got to go talk to the guys in the warehouse." So we went and talked to the guys in the warehouse. So the warehouse guy says, "Well, it's not really my problem. You got to go talk to Eddie. You know, he's driving the forklift. You know, he must have picked up the wrong stuff." So I go talk to Eddie. I have lunch with Eddie. And he says, and I said, "Well, you know, what happened?" He says, "You know, I want you to get up on that forklift." He says, "Sit there," and he says, "and look at something." He says, "What do you see?" I said, "Well, I see a warehouse." He says, "No, what do you really see?" I said, "Well, I see a pretty dark warehouse." He says, "That's right, it's very dark." He says, "Now take a look at those boxes of wine. What do you see?" I said, "Well, I see boxes of wine. They all got labels on them." He says, "Read one of those labels to me." I said, "I can't read it. It's too small." He says, "Aha." He says, "Guess what? We have to remember what's in every one of those because we can't read what's on the box." I said, "Well, what do? Make giant signs?" He says, "Why don't you just make each box a different color for each varietal? And then we would know which one it is." So that's what we did. It turned out to be a brilliant move in the marketplace because all of a sudden Barefoot Wine was very colorful and the displays were very colorful because every box was a different color. What if I hadn't asked?
Hmm. Well, there you go again. Asking, huh? What is it with you and asking questions?
Oh, yeah, it made a big difference.
Yeah.
And we also asked a question of the bottling line manager at the winery where we got our trade services, where we got the bulk wine and the bottling services. And we asked the bottling line manager, we said, "What's our label supposed to look like?" And he said, "Well, I'm no expert," but he took us into the back room where he had a whole library of labels that had been bottled at this winery over decades. And he said, "I'll tell you which ones we bring in here and bottle a lot of. Presumably, they're the ones that are selling and the ones that don't." And he showed us that the ones that were selling the most had a real clean-looking label and an easy-to-read script. And I said, "Wow, that makes a big difference." And the ones that had all the curly Q on them and a dark label, they weren't selling so well. So those were two elements that went into our design as well. And we asked, once again, somebody that's, you know, working on the line, somebody that's touching our product, maybe somebody that's got dirt under their fingernails, people in low places.
Yeah, if you want to improve your strategy, ask the people who are on the front lines. That's great. Now, another trick of the barefoot trade was worthy cause marketing. You pioneered this practice as a way of getting around the fact that you didn't have any money for advertising. So define worthy cause marketing. Where did the idea come from, and how did it transform the business for you?
Well, worthy cause marketing is different than cause marketing. So everybody knows what cause marketing is, which is a company says, we are in favor of this particular cause, and with every purchase you make, we're going to give a dollar to this particular cause. And basically what they're saying to the general public is, you should buy our product because we're supporting the community. And that's wonderful. But worthy cause marketing is a little different. What you're doing in worthy cause marketing is you're actually finding local groups that are trying to do something who are members of the general public that is in the immediate vicinity of the stores and locations where your goods and services are sold, and you're identifying with their goals, and you're helping them with their fundraisers, and you do that in a variety of ways. You don't just give them money. You give them products that they can use to auction off to raise money, or to use with their dinners to when they are trying to raise money. In the case of wine, hopefully it loosens people up and they write bigger checks. But you go beyond that. You actually help them set up. You help them tear down. You help them by taking their message to the marketplace. You take their message and you put it on your bottles. And you have your people there during the fundraisers. You ask them for permission to write a piece of paper that you put down in everybody's place at the fundraising dinner that says why you support their group. And by the way, the products that you're having tonight can be purchased at these 10 retailers. So that's worthy cause marketing. What you're doing is you're marketing your product to the members of the nonprofit organization that you're supporting.
I really like that idea. So now that we understand the concept in its totality, talk about how to implement a strategy of this nature, particularly to those that are listening that don't really have a budget for ads or big marketing campaigns. How does one get started with this?
Well, you find the people and the other companies that benefit when you benefit. For instance, if you've got a sporting goods store, you want to support Wild Rivers, you want to support land conservation, you want to support these kind of community fundraisers and nonprofits where your own customers are going to be. So as you grow, they grow, and you're supporting each other.
I think what's important in worthy cause marketing is that the membership sees you as a member. And when they have a choice of buying goods and services from anybody, they choose you because you're a member.
That's great. I like that. Okay, in your book, The Barefoot Spirit, there's a particular phrase that stuck out for me, and I want you to share it with our listeners. And it goes like this: have you had your brick for the day? So tell us exactly what that means and to have had your brick for the day.
Well, this is part of the humor. You get to a point where you have to get stoic, because when you are an entrepreneur, you're getting hit left and right with these big wake-up calls and these surprises and pop-up challenges. And, we saw an old British movie, you know, where Rodney's in the club, right? And he leans over and he says, "I say, Roscoe, have you had your brick for the day?" And what he means is, you know, what kind of a surprising thing happened to you today that you didn't expect that knocked you off your feet, like a brick falling off the top of a building? And what happens in business is you get going, and then all of a sudden you go, oh my gosh, I had no idea that this worked like this. Like we were saying earlier, we thought the work was making wine. Then we found out the work was really babysitting the distribution channels. We thought that we had all the licenses. Then we find out that we didn't have a license that cost us 10 grand. So those are bricks, and they fall out of the sky and they hit you in the head. So you just have to kind of cop an attitude and look at each other and say, I say, Bonnie, have you had your brick for the day?
Well, I could say coming into the studio, I've had mine for the day, so I'm feeling good about my day. All right, so let me touch on another key to your success that I've heard you mention in other interviews and in your book, and that's the concept of starting small and staying small. Share your thought process behind this, because I know that it runs counterintuitive to the way a lot of entrepreneurs think that they need to think, which is, you know, go big at all costs and so forth. But I happen to really agree and appreciate this particular piece of advice. So please pass it forward to our listening audience.
Okay, well, first of all, you want to start small. And the reason you want to start small is so that you'll make your mistakes in a small place. You can't run around the country hat in hand apologizing to everybody. It's just not feasible.
And you are going to make mistakes.
Boy, are you. And so that's number one. The other thing about staying small is you really got to give yourself a chance to figure out what the real work is. you know, like we said, we thought we're in the wine business, and then we find out we're in the distribution management business. Well, guess what? Distribution management requires lots of people in the field. Now you've got to have people out there in every state where you're selling your product, or your product will just simply disappear. So it needs that attention. So what we learned was, oh my gosh, maybe we don't really need a winery. Maybe we don't need vineyards. Maybe we don't need crush pads and bottling equipment. And the reason we don't is because we should be focusing on sales. So that's what we did. We focused on sales. We put our money in the right place. But and as a result, when we sold the business in 2005, we were the number 12 largest wine brand in the United States. Today it's number one. And we did it with less than 40 people. That's what we mean by staying small. Don't go out and try to bulk up with lots of people and lots of equipment and lots of liabilities. You know, just remember, the bills for that kind of thing go on whether or not you're making sales. Sales are more important than anything else in your business.
You can always contract out for services. That's what we did.
Yeah. That's great, particularly in this day and age. It's easier and easier to source the global talent pool and get them to connect with you all over the globe. So we've been talking a lot about what you did when you didn't have funding for Barefoot, but obviously things started moving and you became quite successful. So explain if or how your mindset and business philosophies changed once you had the money rolling in.
Well, one of the things that we'd realized by this time is that we were being very successful by worthy cause marketing, by having other people spread the word about our product. So we never had an ad. When you put an ad in a magazine or a newspaper, it can cost, you know, thousands of dollars, and it's only as good as the people that can read it at that particular moment, that particular edition. And also, it's something that takes ongoing advertisement. You do it over a long period of time. Well, the people that we were working with in the worthy causes were continuing to spread our word, and we were growing without that expense. So once we had money, we decided to keep it that way because we did realize that these people wouldn't be talking about our product and supporting us because we were supporting them, one, if we weren't supporting them anymore, and two, if we were advertising. So we continued to work with worthy cause marketing, and that obviously paid off for us very well. Another thing is that we were able to afford to pay higher bonuses to our salespeople and to our sales support staff. We had two divisions, sales and sales support, because that's really all you really need. So we'd pay them bonuses as the sales increased. When we had more money, we were able to pay them higher bonuses. And by doing that, you create more of a team player atmosphere. And also, you have less turnover. People are happy with their jobs. They know how they fit in. They know that they have certain responsibilities, and everybody's relying on them to do their best job. And we didn't have turnover, which is really one of the highest costs of any business, whether or not it's on your budget line, whether or not you see it as a cost, it's going to be very high. It takes not only the money of hiring someone else, but you have to take somebody else out of their position to train them, etc. So we had very low turnover.
Excellent advice. So as your final parting thought, I would love if each of you would give your number one piece of advice to a bootstrapping entrepreneurs out there is just getting started. If each of you would just tackle that one most important piece of advice.
Well, I think one of the real key factors for our success was we were able to put ourselves in the other guy's shoes. We were always asking, what is it that you are looking for? If you're a chain store buyer, what is it that you want? If you're a distributor, there's different parts of the distributorship that touch your product. What does each one of those different people want? Put yourself in the other guy's shoes. I would say that's one of the essential reasons why Barefoot was successful.
And what I would say is you're going to make mistakes, so make mistakes right. And we don't mean correct the mistake as fast as you can and slap your hands together and put them behind your back. What we mean is celebrate the mistake, bring it out. And when we say make mistakes right, we mean W-R-I-T-E, write it down. There is a document that has to do with that mistake. I don't care whether it's a checklist, a sign-off sheet, a policy, a procedure, a job description, a sign on the wall, a label on a product. You know, sometimes you put on your pants and you see that sign there that says right leg, left leg, and you wonder, what is that all about? Of course, I know it's my right and left leg. Well, it was for the people on the assembly line. And so that's the thing. You're going to make mistakes, so make mistakes right. Write them down and improve your policies and procedures. When we started our business, our contracts were only 3 pages long. When we sold our business, they were 37 pages long. That's how many mistakes we made.
Wonderful. Well, Michael and Bonnie, this has been great. And so much appreciate you coming in here and sharing your great ideas with our success audience. Congratulations on your success. And thank you so much for being with us here at Success.
Thank you, Darren, very much.
Thanks, Darren.